you can pick up a little bit of extra loss there that'll confuse you. So that's one approach. There are techniques by which you can use the cable as a resonator, and now you measure the Q of resonance. But that's getting a little bit more elaborate. I don't recommend you go there. Hal would recommend you do it by way of a grid dip meter, and you can, but it's going to be a little bit tricky when the cable is that short and the insertion loss is that low. So, and by the way, is there a reason why you must have high accuracy when measuring tenths and hundredths of a dB of insertion loss, John? KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, because it's going to be an assembly of many of those cables to have a selective attenuator. Why they want cable, I'm not sure. It could be done. I have attenuators that go in 0.1 dB attenuations, but they're looking to get some very strange and very low attenuation levels. And when I get below 0.04, even with my power meters or the vector network analyzer or the network analyzer, it's not reliable. It seems to change as you're viewing it. That could be interference from radiation going past the cable, possibly. That I'm not sure, and I didn't really get into it heavily. I wanted to speak to you first because I just found that inconsistent with 6 dB loss as rated.
And as long as you've got connectors that are well installed in the end of the cable, a good connector can give you a healthy 70, 80 dB of isolation. Particularly on double shielded cable, you can get 100 dB. If you've got 100 dB of shielding on each end of that piece of cable with double braid, and now you compare the signal flowing down the center versus the leakage signal, and the leakage signal is 100 dB weaker, and now you combine 100 dB weaker signal in phase and out of phase to find out what's the maximum ripple it can be caused, I'll bet you the answer is like 0.01 dB or 0.001 dB, and I can run that one by a little bit later. I know the mathematics on that one. By the way, what you do to do that is you, because Mother Nature always thinks in voltage, not in power, you assume that the leakage signal is, let me pick a number, 100 dB down. 100 dB, you now convert it by the voltage formula back into a real ratio, which means you take, it's not 10 log, it's 20 log. So you take your 100 dB, divide it by 20, and you get the number of 5. And now you do an anti-log of 5, and you now know the ratio. And by the way, the anti-log of 5 to the power of 10 is exactly 100,000 to 1. Therefore, the leakage signal is 100,000 times weaker in voltage than the main signal. And now you take that 100,000 times weaker signal, and you add it in a positive manner and a negative manner, and now you look at the peak to valley in decibels, convert it back to decibels. And I think we're talking about micro decibels here, if you know what I mean. Micro bells. So, in the case of testing a receiver, let me drop it. Where you're trying to put a super weak signal down the center of the cable, you're measuring the sensitivity of a good receiver, and you're putting a signal down there of minus 120. And the leakage of the cabinet of the signal generator, the real oscillator inside the signal generator, is running 0 dBm. And you're trying to put minus 120 dBm down the cable, and the leakage of the cabinet of the signal generator is 120 dB down. You can easily get to the situation where the leakage from the cabinet of the signal generator and the length of and the strength of the signal going down the center of the cable are equal to each other. And if your receiver isn't well shielded and it starts picking up the leakage signal, you can now get some peculiar results. But in your case, now in that particular case I'm describing, the leakage signal and the desired signal are very close in amplitude. In your case, the leakage signal and the desired signal are 100 decibels apart. You've got a much friendlier environment. In your case, unless you've got a connector that's essentially falling off the end of the cable, so to speak, don't worry about leakage in your case. Worry about the connectivity of the cable, of the connector. Let me describe that one in a minute. When you're starting to get down to insertion losses like you're talking about, 0.01, 0.03 dB, whether or not you properly torque the type N connector when you put it onto the signal generator and onto the power meter. And it's going to make a difference. And if you completely disconnect it and reconnect it, the second time you connect the cable, you're going to get a slightly different insertion loss when you start measuring numbers that are so damn small like you're describing. You get a little bit of lack of repeatability, which is not necessarily a defective connector. We're now getting down to the laws of physics here, John. You're into a pretty strange world. The National Bureau of Standards makes measurements like this. To do it, though, on Toad Hill in Staten Island, that's a little bit of a challenge. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, it is a little frustrating, and definitely, when I use a torque wrench on those connectors, you'll get a particular waveform. If you remove the connector or loosen it up sufficiently and retorque it again, that waveform is going to look slightly different. Yeah, that's something a lot of people don't realize. But I like your idea of measuring it in a reflected mode and then dividing that in half. That should get me down to the small numbers that I'm looking to measure, because I'll have it doubled, just cut it in half. So if I can measure 4, I know I can count on it as 2. So yeah, that's what I'm going to try next. A good recommendation. Thank you. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I'm going to continue right now with the potentiometer discussion from last week. I'm going to give you a little bit of a review and show you something brand new about potentiometers. Potentiometers are extremely handy control, particularly on our old-fashioned analog receivers. Nowadays, a larger and larger number of knobs on the front panel, when you twist it, it really is a digital shaft encoder, which issues a digital code to the microprocessor inside the transceiver and tells it where the knob is and where you've turned it. But in the older days, we had real potentiometers. It was a beautiful circuit for adjusting the volume of the audio, the RF gain, the AGC, the BFO settings in some cases, and some receivers that even changed the frequency. The main frequency dial was a potentiometer, but a potentiometer, which is a kind of resistor divider network, is still being used, still has a lot of purpose, and there's things that can be done with it you may not have known about. Let me drop. So make believe now that we are Superman, we've got X-ray vision, we've got a potentiometer sitting on the table in front of us, and the shaft is up toward you, and the back of the potentiometer is flat on the table, and you're looking at a top view. What would you see? The actual active element inside of the round package of this potentiometer is a resistive card. It is a round piece of printed circuit board that around the perimeter of that printed circuit board, it has resistive material laid down by a deposition process or a painting process. And so, it's a nearly complete circle. In other words, you're looking down on this thing, and the resistive material might start at the 1 o'clock position, and it goes all the way around the perimeter from 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, all the way around to 11 o'clock. So the resistive material starts at 1 o'clock, goes around to at 11 o'clock. And there is a connector coming out of it at the 1 o'clock position. There's a connector coming out at the 11 o'clock position that connects directly to that resistive card. At the 12 o'clock position, there's another connector which does not touch the resistive card directly. It's got a connector that goes over to a pivot in the center that's connected to the shaft. That pivot has a little bit of a pointer, and the pointer, at the tip of that pointer, it's like the hour hand. It touches the resistive card. It's got a little piece of finger stock on the end of that hour hand. So as you turn the shaft of the potentiometer, the connector at the point at the 12 o'clock position is now sliding across that resistive card from 1 o'clock toward 11 o'clock. The typical way you and I would use the potentiometer, let me drop, is you would take the 1 o'clock connector and ground it. The 11 o'clock connector, you would connect it to the source of signal. It may be the audio output of the detector stage of your receiver. So now, the resistive card might be a 100K resistor, if it was a old-fashioned tube-type radio. 500K was also very popular. But I'm going to use 100K because the numbers come out evenly. It's a 100K resistor. You're applying the signal at the 11 o'clock position, and it's being grounded at the 1 o'clock position. And if now you adjusted the knob, you turned it so that it's halfway between the counterclockwise and clockwise positions, so now the pointer, the hour hand, so to speak, is sitting at 6 o'clock. You've now got exactly a 2-to-1 resistor divider. In other words, the voltage is proportionally going across that resistive card that's on the perimeter of that printed circuit board inside. You're picking up the voltage that's going to go out to your next audio amplifier stage from the connector that's at the 12 o'clock position. It really is connected to a pointer that is touching the resistive card at 6 o'clock, halfway between the grounded 1 o'clock position and the full signal at the 11 o'clock position. You can sort of see now that as you turn the knob clockwise, you're going closer to 7, 8, 9, 10, and eventually 11 o'clock on the pointer, on the hour hand, so to speak, and you're going to be picking up full volume signal. And conversely, when you turn it counterclockwise down toward 1 o'clock, you go toward zero signal. Let me drop. What I just described is a typical way of using a typical potentiometer. And by the way, potentiometers come in all kinds of sizes, all the way down to a size that's hard to see without a magnifying glass, up to something that's going to be very large that I'm going to describe to you in a couple of minutes. But now, you could if you want to. In the old days, there was a very special kind of potentiometer you could buy. I don't know if it's still available, which has not only a connector at the 1 o'clock position and the 11 o'clock position, but you can buy a potentiometer that has a whole series of other connectors touching the resistive card. And the other connectors could be one at the 2 o'clock, one at the 3 o'clock, one at the 4 o'clock, and so on. You could have 11 total connectors touching the resistive card. And why in the world would you want to do that? Okay, let me give you a couple of examples. Tap, potentiometer, Dick. You could call those voltage taps. And you could use those voltage taps in all kinds of crazy ways. You could, if you want to, take the voltage tap at the 4 o'clock position and ground it. You think about that? Yes, you could do that. And you could take the signal coming out of your source of signal, connected simultaneously to the 11 o'clock position and the 3 o'clock position. What would happen if you did that? You start off with the potentiometer at the lowest possible setting. Your pointer is at 1 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, which is the grounded one. You get no signal. As you rotate toward 3 o'clock, you're getting louder and louder signal. As you rotate from 3 o'clock down to 4 o'clock, which is grounded again, the signal goes back down. As you then rotate beyond 4 o'clock, the signal comes back up. So you could have this weird characteristic where you turn the knob, the signal comes up, goes down, and then starts coming up again with a continuous clockwise turning of the knob. That's one possible way. There's another. You could decide to put the left-hand audio, this is a stereo receiver, let me drop. You could put the left-hand audio at the 11 o'clock position, the right-hand audio at, say, the 5 o'clock position, and now as you rotate the knob, you'll go from no audio when the pointer is at 1 o'clock. As it goes toward 5 o'clock, you'll hear full volume of audio of either left or right speaker, and then depending on where you ground it, it goes to zero, and then as you continue turning it, you start hearing louder and louder audio of the other earphone. So you could have two different sources of audio, left and right in my case, or it could be two thoroughly independent programs. And depending on which hemisphere of the rotation of the knob on the front panel, you decide your audio amplifier is going to hear program A or program B coming out of the exact same receiver, because there's really two receivers inside, but you want to control which one you're listening to. And there's various ways that you can set this up so that you get a mixture of those two signals. And now the ratio of signal A and signal B can be changed by way of a potentiometer with multiple taps. But let me show you something even further. We can go on with this.
Hey, those are all linear things.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be linear. By way of various resistors that I put on those taps on the outside, I could take a linear potentiometer and convert it into a logarithmic potentiometer by putting just the right resistors across those terminals on the outside. I wonder if you've done things along those lines, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Many times. Actually, you'll find in a lot of radio console, you will find 16 individual taps to cross the pot, a very big pot. They use them as step attenuators. But the point that I was getting at, there's different types of tapers. You should tell people what the tapers are, why there's a linear taper and an audio taper, and what they do.
6DPZ with comment. Eric, why don't you tell us why they use a linear taper, logarithmic taper, or inverse log taper? Why do they do that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Now you have a teacher, but linear tapers are just what it is, linear. If you take that circle and you divide it into four pieces, you'll get, at the 6 o'clock position, you'll get half its value. At the other positions, you'll get a quarter of its value, and along the wiper, it's a linear resistance change. An audio taper is really a logarithmic taper, and the reason for that is the way audio is being, your hearing being logarithmic in nature, it makes for a more human feel in terms of where you turn the knob as to where the volume is. There are lots of other reasons for it, but that's just one particular one. K2RIW, K2EJ.
DPZ with comment.
Tom,
I'm going to finish this statement and then I'm going to go over to Hal. Turns out that a human hearing system and the human vision system are essentially logarithmic. The good news is that your hearing system has got a huge dynamic range, approximately 120 decibels between the weakest signal your ears will respond to, if you've got a good hearing system, versus the strongest signal, which is near the threshold of pain, 120 decibels. That is a ratio of, let me think now, 100 billion to 1 in power. It's either 100 billion to 1 or 1,000. Maybe a trillion to one. It's a huge number, in other words. And the only way that a system can have that much dynamic range is it's got to be logarithmic in response. You can't build a pure linear detector to have that much dynamic range. So your eye system and your hearing system is logarithmic. So if you make the potentiometer have a logarithmic taper to its resistance versus rotation of its knob, then the amount of volume you hear out of the loudspeaker changes in a pleasant ratio as far as your hearing system is concerned as you turn that knob. Let's see what Hal's got to say on all this. K6DBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K6DBZ. You mentioned log and linear, and it's very easy to determine if you have a pot and you're not sure if it's either log, you know, if it's a linear pot or it's a log pot. Put a voltmeter battery across the outside legs of the pots and take a voltmeter and put it from the center arm to one side of the pot. And as you rotate your control section of the pot, if the voltage goes to half when you're halfway, then you know basically it's a linear pot. If it is erratic and the voltage just jumps up as you go sweeping it through, the chances are it's an audio taper pot, a log pot.
Now, one good way of doing it is under real working conditions, like Hal mentioned, put a voltage across the potentiometer and measure voltage with your voltmeter between center cap and ground, so to speak, as you rotate it. You could also do it with an ohmmeter by putting your ohmmeter between center cap and one end of the pot, and then try the other end as you rotate it and recognize the rate at which the number of ohms you measure goes up or down as you rotate it. Again, keeping track of how many degrees you've rotated versus how many ohms you've seen change, you'll also, again, rotate. You'll recognize the difference between a linear and a logarithmic taper. Let me drop. Now, there's something else you can do once you've got a pot with all kinds of taps to it. You could save yourself a stage of amplification if you wanted to. In other words, Let's assume now that I've got a fairly low impedance source of signal that I put into the potentiometer, my audio output. And because I was describing last week what happens with the output impedance of a potentiometer, when the potentiometer is turned to minimum, where the slider, the hour hand, so to speak, is at 1 o'clock in my example, the output impedance of the potentiometer is, by definition, 0 ohms. If it was a 100K pot, and it's a linear pot, and if my source of signal has got a very low impedance connected to the 11 o'clock position, when my pot is set halfway in volume, when the slider is at the 6 o'clock position, and it's a 100K total resistance pot, I've really got 50K between 6 o'clock and 1 o'clock. I got 50K ohms between 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And because each end of the pot is a very low impedance, in my example, I therefore see a pair of 50K resistors in parallel. My output impedance at that point will be roughly 25 kilo ohms. If my particular audio amplifier happened to have an input impedance, because it's a transistorized amplifier and I'm going into the base of the very next stage, it might have an input impedance of 25 kilo ohms. Therefore, let me drop. Therefore, by the half voltage method of calculating, in other words, if I was taking the output voltage from this potentiometer and going into a high impedance sensing device, like an oscilloscope, and I recognize that I get zero voltage output from the potentiometer when the slider is at the 1 o'clock position, I get exactly half voltage at the 6 o'clock position, I get full voltage at the 11 o'clock position, I've all measured this into a high impedance oscilloscope, and I can see now the proportionality of voltage versus rotation. But because now my real load is going to be an audio amplifier with a 25K input impedance, and at the center of the pot, it's got a 25K Thevenin equivalent resistance or impedance, you can see that I'm really going to get half of the voltage. I'm going to be 6 dB down from the calculation of volume versus rotation. There's lots of ways you can correct this. You can put an operational amplifier in there as a voltage follower. You can put an emitter follower stage in there. There's ways you can take your audio amplifier, of my example, and raise its input impedance so that things start behaving in a more linear manner. But there's something else you can do here. Let me drop. Because my example of my particular audio amplifier happens to have a fairly lousy design. It's got a 25K input impedance, and that input impedance happens to be a significant number of picofarads to ground. It's a capacitive loaded input circuit of my audio amplifier. When the potentiometer is set at a very low number or a very high number, you override that capacitive shunting effect. But when the pot is set in the middle, now the 25K Thevenin impedance of the potentiometer going into a heavily capacitively loaded input circuit of my audio amplifier means that I might start losing the high frequency notes. And I can compensate for this. With all of those taps on the outside, I could put the right arrangement of shunting capacitors, inductors, or whatever. I can make a wave-shaping network, so to speak. When you got a whole lot of taps on a potentiometer, you can do all kinds of fancy things by correcting for impedance match. I could use it as an equalizer network. I can now, in a passive manner, putting inductors, capacitors, and resistors on those taps on the outside, I can do a lot of correction and make things more linear for this particular design of a circuit that I'm now going to be building 1,000 of and going to manufacture of them. And I don't want to put in another stage of amplification. I want to do something cheaper and simpler because the potentiometer is already there. It's a ridiculous situation that I just described because in reality, the pot with a whole lot of taps is an expensive pot. And if I'm trying to make maximum profit, I probably wouldn't have been using that component in the first place. Let me drop. But now you accept the fact that I can build a potentiometer with a whole lot of taps. Under normal circumstances, that potentiometer I just described might be an object that's an inch and a half in diameter with a whole bunch of leads around that perimeter where I can do all this tapping. Turns out that there is a multi-tap potentiometer in my basement. And I've experienced this one a little bit. Let me drop. Assume this is Hurricane Sandy again, and seawater is pouring into my basement. Now, I've got a washer machine and a dryer, each of which are about 3 feet high off the floor, maybe 3.5 feet. And they're both connected to the 110-volt line. As the seawater in my basement starts rising, and the seawater is touching all of that wiring inside of that washer machine and dryer, and the power is turned on, I'm now injecting voltage into that very low impedance resistive card called seawater. It's a volumetric resistive material which has 0.2 ohms per meter. Very low impedance potentiometer. And somewhere else in my basement, there's a grounded oil tank with a copper line coming out of it that's all grounded. But I suddenly realize there's another couple of things in my basement that are putting taps in the potentiometer, so to speak. I've got the main fuse panel. The good news about it is it's more like about 6 feet off the floor. Until the water gets up to 6 feet, it's not going to be touching the wiring directly of the fuse panel. So from that point of view, you would think at first, well, as long as my washing machine and my dryer are unplugged, I'm safe. Not at all. Let me drop. That washer and dryer, in my case, is against the eastern wall of the basement. My fuse panel is against the northern wall of the basement. My oil tank is against the southern wall of the basement. The western wall of my basement happens to have an oil-fired furnace and an oil-fired hot water heater. The oil-fired burner for each of those is about 6 inches off the floor. When the seawater in my basement gets up to 6 inches, it's now being bathed by the voltage that's on those two items. So as you can see, I've now got this very complicated multi-terminal potentiometer called seawater in my basement. Various objects in the basement are grounded. Various objects at various altitudes and various locations are injecting 120 or 240 volts into that seawater. If I'm now walking around in that seawater, and I'm now standing in various places, I'm going to be getting various voltages between my left leg, my right leg, my left arm, my right arm, the left-hand side of my body, the right-hand side of my body. Depending on how I'm oriented, where I'm standing in that basement, I'm going to be getting electric voltage flowing through me. Let me drop. On the eastern coast of the United States, including Bermuda and the Caribbean area, 265 people died because of Hurricane Gloria. Most of those were Americans, by the way. In the New York City area, something like 65 people died. When you go to the right website, which now breaks it down to individual human beings, where it shows you their picture, describes their history, describes where they were when they died, a number of them are directly called electrocution. A high percentage of them died in the basement of their house because they went down there to recover their laptop, their fancy pictures, or whatever. The bottom line of all this is that potentiometer called seawater in your basement. If seawater is pouring into your basement, I don't care how valuable the stuff is, don't go there. Now, this is a slightly controversial area. Let me drop. There was a person who is a frequent contributor to the TechNet, whose opinion I honor, whose opinion I respect, who told me that I'm bringing up a subject that's very uncomfortable for a number of people, and that is people who died during Hurricane Gloria. I can understand some people are going to be uncomfortable to hear these details. However, my philosophy is the following. If by giving out this information as to how dangerous seawater is because of electrocution in your basement, and if one human being is saved by that, and 100 people are offended by that discussion, by possibly the cost-to-benefit ratio is the right way to go. I'd much rather have people have information that keeps them alive rather than keep that information away from them because it might offend somebody. I know that not everyone's going to agree with me on that one. But as you can see, water and electricity are a very dangerous combination. Be awful careful. Anybody with any further comments or questions, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
Now, skipping the electrocution part, actually, there were me. I yanked the meter before anything. But, have you ever seen a 360-degree potentiometer?
I haven't, but I can see how they would exist, Eric. It would have a peculiar characteristic of voltage versus position as it traverses, in my example, between the 11 o'clock position and the 1 o'clock position. What would that output of that potentiometer look like, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLAW.
No, interestingly enough, I actually used quite a few of them in some of the gear here. Let's put it this way. If you were to, say, attach a motor to the potentiometer and rotate it rather slowly, or even fast, you get a sawtooth.
Yeah, I can see how the potentiometer could now be a continuous circle of the resist card. You've got a contact giving you an input signal at 12 o'clock. You've got a ground or a negative signal at 6 o'clock. And now as you rotate that and look at the output voltage from the hour hand, so to speak, yes, if it's a linear pot, you'll get a sawtooth waveform. And so I'd much rather see a sawtooth waveform created electronically, because when you do things like this electromechanically, eventually it's a matter of time before you start wearing out the resistive card with that motor continuously driving it, and you're going to start getting some scratchy contacts. And by the way, there's a whole art and science of squirting the right kind of chemistry inside of a scratchy potentiometer, electronically scratchy, in order to stop that scratchiness. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2IW, K2EJ. Now, a lot of this stuff came from when they used to use cell phones, actually. It's really more used for position information lasers. They require a little more than 360 degrees of rotation. And believe it or not, some of the zoom lenses on cameras have them in them. So those parts are really rugged. I mean, they're not designed to be driven around and around and around. Go to a position, stay put. And in a lot of cases, the motor controllers or servos would actually look like a wing bridge, so, interestingly enough. So they actually are out there. And believe it or not, one of the manufacturers, I think they just had like an overrun of these parts. Most of the switchers that were made, I would say from like the 60s on to until we've finally gone to, you know, everything being computer-based, the data handle, the thing that handled it, the guy would move to change, to dissolve from one camera to the other, happened to be one of these 360-degree parts, so very linear, and the accuracy was something like 1%, and some of them were even better than that. They were really super precision resistance. K2IW, K2EJ.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, John, and I've got a comment on this one, too. Turns out almost every one of us owns a more than 360-degree potentiometer. Go ahead, John.
I'm not talking about a 10-cent pot.
Nor am I. Go ahead, John.
I don't think they make 10-cent pots anymore, Eric. my question is, wouldn't it be a triangle wave, not a sawtooth?
There's a yes and a no to that. If 12 o'clock was connected to plus 1 volt, at 6 o'clock is connected to minus 1 volt,
and it's linear,
you would now make a sawtooth, no, it's a triangular waveform, you're right, it's a triangular waveform, the peak would be plus 1, the value would be minus 1, and there'd be a pair of zeros in between, it would be a triangular waveform, you're right, it wouldn't be sawtooth.
We'd have a sawtooth with a nonlinear pot though, right?
No. With a nonlinear pot, you'd have a different slope to the upper going and the downward going portion of the triangular waveform. To make a sawtooth waveform, you're really trying to, at one particular point, instantaneously jump from plus 1 volt down to minus 1 volt. To do that with a potentiometer reliably is not easy, but maybe Eric knows a way. Go ahead, Eric.
6DPZ with a comment.
Okay, you're both wrong. Alright, well, depends how you want to look at it. Consider this. Alright, take a circle with 360 degrees, and then take a knife, and just cut a tiny little slot there, and they actually make the wipers so that it makes a very clean transition from maximum resistance to minimum resistance. When the wiper moves past that point, alright, so if you add a positive voltage, all of a sudden it's a negative voltage. That's a sawtooth, not a triangle. and then, you know, the whole process starts all over again. Even if you had, say, plus one on the 11 o'clock terminal and minus one on the 1 o'clock terminal, although they're right next to each other, you would still get that large jump from the positive to the negative. And, you know, it would essentially be like throwing a switch, so you get sort of KQRW, KQRW.
HAL's recognized. And as long as you make that slider with that very narrow slot you just described, make the slider so that it is a break before make as it goes across that gap. And you make the real gap between the break and the make extremely small, you'll get something that'll look like a pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good sawtooth waveform. See what HAL's got to say. K60PZ, that you built some fancy pots. K2RIW, the pot man.
K2RIW and the group K60PZ. You mentioned primarily carbon pots. You know, I don't have pots too, if you talk a little bit about that.
No, I forgot to mention that most of these 360s are wire wound.
Turns out every one of us who owns a Cornell Dubilier Ham M rotator, and you look inside, the potentiometer in there is a 380 degree potentiometer. You're about to ask, how the hell did they do that? By the way, it's wire wound. And as it makes its full 380 degree turn, it is wound on a card that is inside view, a spiral card. In other words, the card raises up slightly so that the overlapped region doesn't touch. And the slider is made in such a way that it can tolerate the change in altitude as it rotates. So that resistive wire wound potentiometer.
Yeah, but it has end stops.
Yeah, the end stops, though, are a mechanical stop of the gear mechanism of the rotator. The stop is not built into the potentiometer. So that wire wound potentiometer on your Ham M, it really is built for 380 degrees, even though your screen only needs 360 degrees to display. And when you go through the calibration procedure, you'll notice that in some cases, you can make the Dawson valve movement move below the minus 180 degree point on the left side and above the minus 180 degree point on the right hand side. And so the stop is mechanical with the gearing mechanism, not with the potentiometer. So that's one step toward the so-called 10 turn. Let me drop. And by the spiral winding technique, the Bourne's company, among others, makes a whole lot of very precision 10 turn potentiometers. And now as mechanical rotation takes place and the number of ohms or volts you get out of it changes, it can be extremely linear, like 2/10 or 1/10 of a percent linearity out of some of those Bourne's pots. And so the actual frequency selecting dial on a number of the brand names of old-fashioned spectrum analyzers really was a 10-turn pot geared down just right going to the front panel knob, sometimes with a vernier dial, so that that selected the voltage that went to a very fancy constant current generator circuit that in turn drove a constant amount of current into the coil of a Yig-tuned oscillator. And that whole system, the linearity of the Yig-tuned oscillator, the linearity of the 10-turn potentiometer, all the mechanics and electronics in between, you could achieve numbers like 0.5% of frequency accuracy by way of that mechanical arrangement I just described. And if you then combine that with a precision voltmeter, measuring that voltage coming off that pot and displaying it as a digital display with the right kind of electronic offsetting gain, you now could, with a digital display, read the apparent frequency of the spectrum analyzer. That's the way the AIL spectrum analyzer worked, and I think they claimed
the Tektronix 7012 is just fine.
Takes DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, I think the many of those spectrum analyzers claimed 0.5% of absolute frequency accuracy on that dial. And by way of the internal calibrator, which put out comb lines at every 100 megacycles or so, in the case of the Hewlett-Packard, and in case of the AIL, you could then get even finer accuracy than that. So I bet you've seen a lot of these 10-turn pots and some of the things you worked on and had to repair. Is that true, Al? K6DPZ, K2LAW.
K6DPZ. Yeah, 10-turn pots. I had a late sweep on a lot of the Tektronix scopes and other scopes, stuff like that. But I just wanted to mention, on a wire-wound pot, the way they make that, instead of linear, log, the plate that the wire is wrapped on is more on a, like a triangle. It gets smaller, so the wiper sees less resistance as it's passing around the plate deck. Do you follow what I'm getting at?
I sure do. So you start off with a very shallow triangular-shaped card. You wrapped wire on that card, and then that whole card gets turned, gets rotated into a circular pattern where the wiper is going to pick onto that. In the case of a Ham-Am rotator, you'll notice that the wire winding of that potentiometer eventually builds up copper oxide. Therefore, in certain directions on your Ham-Am, like maybe to the east or the west, a direction you don't go to very often, you'll notice that the meter becomes kind of erratic because of the oxide on that potentiometer. You'll also notice that if you exercise a particular region of your Ham-Am rotator day in and day out, you'll slowly scrape through that copper oxide and the machine becomes more and more reliable. So if it's a region that you never go to and you finally go there one day, you'll find it's kind of erratic. That's the disadvantage of that kind of a potentiometer, the wire-wound potentiometer that's in a Ham-Am. Anybody have any further comments on amateur radio rotators? K2LIW listening. Yeah, potentiometers are fun. It's a very useful item. They've got their idiosyncrasies, but the idiosyncrasies they have are fairly deterministic. In other words, they're reasonably well known. There's a catch, though. When you work in the world of military electronics and you're trying to make something extremely reliable so it can survive so-called battle-short conditions, as they call it, and you've got a group of people reviewing your design, the reliability department and the maintainability department is reviewing your design before you're allowed to go into production, they will give you a tremendous amount of grief concerning every single potentiometer you are using in that electronics. Of all the components that are used in electronics, near the top of the list of unreliable components is a potentiometer. And as such, you should come up with a design that uses the bare minimum of potentiometers when it comes to military electronics. And when you are using a potentiometer and you have no choice but to use it, you in many cases are forced to put another pair of resistors between the slider and each end of the potentiometer so that if the slider becomes a complete open circuit, at least by way of the external resistors that you've installed, you are at least getting a medium voltage somewhere between the maximum and minimum of that potentiometer. You're getting some kind of a medium voltage out of it as opposed to a pure open circuit that could cause a complete failure of your circuit. Anybody have any further comments? K2LIW listening.
The John has a mailbag question. I'm prepared to answer, but I can't stay here for too much longer, so you wouldn't mind to move on to that. And by the way, more and more, we don't use potentiometers. We use electronic potentiometers. It's a whole other discussion. K2LIW, K2LIW.
Which I'm guessing are really a shaft encoder into a digital circuit. Is that approximately it, Eric? And we're going to go very next to the mailbag. I'll go ahead for a comment on that one, Eric.
Yeah, well, you'll see more and more stuff as we go to the touchscreen business that you're generally using either some kind of capacitive switch or something like that to control a electronically variable. What it really is a... is an op-amp controlling a bias on a resistor, on a transistor acting as a resistor. So you're seeing more and more of that kind of stuff these days.
Very fine. And any of these touchscreens, the way the touchscreen really works is that there's a layer of fingers built into the transparent glass, which are made out of tin oxide. Tin oxide is a transparent material that's conductive. And there's a circuit in there putting roughly 100 kilohertz across those pieces of tin oxide. As you bring your finger close to that particular position, the capacitive coupling between your finger and the tin oxide, with a 32nd of an inch of glass between you and the tin oxide, changes the capacitance. The circuit recognizes that capacitance change on finger number 14, and it says, hey, Eric is putting his finger near tin oxide finger number 14. He must be selecting voltage 14 on that screen. Those things work very well. And one of the things that we discovered, let me drop, is that some of those touchscreen sensing circuits are so extremely well designed that you can build them as part of an antenna, and you're transmitting signals through that screen, and yet the touchscreen circuit works like a charm when the transmitter is on. That was a very pleasant disguise, a very pleasant surprise on one of the projects I worked on. John, please read us one of the mailbag goodies. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Yeah, I have a gentleman who has a waveform monitor, which I spoke to Eric earlier about this. It's a model 601A, and it's used in commercial broadcast, or it was used in commercial broadcast, and it has a function that he'd like to have your interpretation and Eric's interpretation of. Basically, what does the function do, what is it used for, how is it created, things like that, and any general notes on the monitor itself. Like I said, it's a 601A waveform monitor. And the function button he doesn't understand is the one marked bow tie. So if you could have some words on that, that would be appreciated. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And I think that's a Tektronix 601A. You didn't mention the word Tektronix. Eric? I know what a vectorscope looks like, but I've never heard of butterfly for broadcast transmissions. That sounds like something you'd use on sideband, but you guys don't use sideband in broadcast. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good night, K2RIW, K2EJ. First of all, the Tektronix WFM 601A, they made three different ones. 601A, 601E is an Edward, and a 601M, as in Mary, or maintenance, actually, that's what the M is for. The 601A is a serial digital interface, the source code, SDI. It doesn't take analog video signals in. It takes serial digital video in, and it's only standard definition. So the bit rate that goes into it is 270 megabits. Right? The 601A was really designed to be used at a camera station, or just at a plain old video monitoring station. I'm going to drop for a second.
Oh, yeah.
So, when you turn the 601A on and you feed video, a serial digital video into it, it will actually display the video signal in the traditional way that you're used to seeing it. What it does is it takes the digit, puts it into a D-A, and turns it back into analog the way you're normally used to seeing it. Now, serial digital, SDI, serial digital interface, is actually broken up into 10 bits of luminance, 8 bits of luminance minus blue, and 8 bits of luminance minus red. So there's actually three packets of data that you're interested in. And the scope will allow you to display each one independently. Okay, the scope also has a mode where you push button and it displays the traditional vectorscope that you've seen. It also does some other stuff called an arrowhead and a diamond head. What the arrowhead does is it displays the chrominance in relation to the luminance on the screen. And what the diamond head does is it allows you to see the chrominance in relation to the RGB, or the red, green, and blue components, rather than the matrix components, which is the luminance minus blue and the luminance minus red. So now you've got all this information for the camera operator to be able to balance his camera and make it look nice and make sure that the skin tones are correct and the colors are right. Let it drop again.
Really, is that so?
Okay. Now, how are we doing here? There are some other functions in this scope, and they're test functions. For example, it will display the ISIC, and it will let you know whether your digital clock is jittering, meaning that the streams, the data are coming in equally in time, 1, 2, 3, 4, without any differential in time between each packet. It requires no special test signal. So, to answer this gentleman's question, when you press the button on it that says bow tie, you need to have somewhere in the system a special signal that's generated called the bow tie signal. It's actually it looks like a bow tie when you see it on the scope, but it's got little tick marks every 20 nanoseconds. And you'll see two of them side by side. The one on the left will be the luminance packet. The one on the right will be either luminance minus blue or luminance minus red. There's also a mode we can put all three of them up. The gradual is actually marked off with a little ticks. And what it's for is as you pass the signal through a piece of gear, because you actually have three separate channels, by looking at the lines and the tick marks and where the bow tie comes together in the center and how they line up, you can determine whether there's any timing difference between the sweeps of packets. It allows you to see if the luminance is being slightly delayed from the chrominance, or the chrominance is being slightly delayed from the luminance, or the chrominance red or the chrominance blue has a timing difference between the two of them. It requires a special test signal that's being generated. By the way, they run at, I think it's, one is at 501 kilohertz, so the chrominance is at 502 kilohertz, and the chrominance, the two chrominance packets are actually overlaid on one another so that you can see that there's amplitude differences by looking at the center and seeing if the center is a nice, really still crossing of the center, or the line fattens up because of a different amplitude. K2RWK to the J.
Oh, very good. That was great. We love that.
Now, by the number of tachyonics being as low as it is, 601A, would lead me to believe was built somewhere around 1995 or so, 1985 or so. And there wasn't a lot of digital television way back then, so I'm a little confused by the digital sounding function of this thing being a serial and digital interface. Sounds like there's an anachronism here between when it was built and modern-day digital television. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Oh, really? Is that so?
Stand by a second while I make an adjustment here. Do that while I'm talking. You are making a connection between two words of digital that completely have nothing to do with one another. Whereas over-the-air digital television is a completely different format, and the maximum bit rate is 20 megabits, 19.39 megabits, and serial digital video, not over-the-air broadcasting, is stuff that comes out of the camera. That's been around since, actually, that first started in, I think, about 80. I got the first machines when I was working at this place. That was 84, 85 in that neighborhood. K2RAW, K2EJ.
Is that so?
Good question, Dick.
Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
Hey, John.
Eric, would there be any application in the digital SLR formats? Could that be used on this piece of equipment for any application?
Actually, it could. Now, first of all, you don't see serial digital interfaces because of the licensing. We're only using professional broadcast equipment. What is in consumer land is something called HDMI. It's organized the same way in terms of the data that's available, and the data rates conform to what SDI is, because even in high depth, HDSDI runs at 1.482 gigabits. And don't forget, these are serial streams, and you have to go from serial to parallel to work on them. So, whatever the terminal gear is, the reason for the serial stream is that you don't need 10 wires for each channel. You use one piece of coax for everything. So, you would have to, for him to use it with any HDMI device, he would have to go out and buy himself a little black magic converter. It will take in HDMI and spit out SDI.
A word.
Very good. Maybe that's his intention, I'm not sure. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
A word.
Why don't you, because we've had a hiatus of the mailbag last week and this week, we could go to one more mailbag item if you want to, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I have one scientist here, young gentleman, who understands. He has a couple of gyroscopes. Let him drop. He has a pretty firm understanding of how they work, and he plays with them a lot. What he's asking is, how do they use a gyroscope in navigation? How does that aid them? You know, he understands they try to maintain their position, but how do they couple all that information to a satellite or into a rocket ship that's traveling? Interesting question. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, from the PBS programs that I've seen on the subject, one of the very early uses of a gyroscope guidance system in a rocket was done by Mr. Werner von Braun from Peenemünde, Germany, in the beginning of World War II, or somewhere in the middle of World War II. A gyroscope, if you're careful enough to mount it on a gimballing system, in other words, a set of pivots, which has extremely low friction, and the whole gimballing system with the gyroscope is extremely well balanced, if you can achieve that, and if you spin the gyroscope fast enough, then its drift rate from holding an ideal position could be extremely slow. I am guessing it's possible to achieve a drift rate of 1 degree per hour, so to speak. And since your missile is only going to fly for 10 minutes, that's more than good enough. But if you set up a gyroscope, a well-made gyroscope, and a good gimballing system, so that the axis of the gyroscope is directly parallel to the z-axis with a Cartesian coordinate system, then as the object that the gyroscope is mounted in is changed in orientation, that gyroscope will hold that position in inertial space, even in the presence of changing gravity, changing acceleration, and so on, if you've done a good enough job. And so one gyroscope parallel to the z-axis in its rotation, the shaft, and another gyroscope parallel to the x-axis can give you, let me think now, just about everything you want to know. It'll tell you any rotation in azimuth, any rotation in elevation, and so in three-dimensional coordinate system, those two right-angle gyroscopes could give you a very good system. In the case of
repeater, timeout.
I'm glad to see that the Eastern repeater came back. And by the way, the Eastern repeater is a bit noisy tonight, with my audio sounding a little bit yucky. But what I was starting to say is the gyroscope system on, what was I going to talk about now? A V2 rocket is one. Gyroscopes are used on many of the spacecraft. Oh, yes. The equivalent of a gyroscope is called an inertial wheel. If you build a very large version of a gyroscope, and you set them up, two or three of them, at least three of them would be nice, one parallel to the x-axis, one parallel to the y, and one parallel to the z. And if the mass of the gyroscope rotor is large enough, then all you have to do is turn on a motor that attempts to speed up or slow down a appropriate one of those three inertial wheel slash gyroscope things. Let me drop. Because of Newton's third law, where every action has a reaction, when you try to speed up the gyroscope,